I have one bit of banter today.
Okay.
And it's that I've been having very strange dreams lately.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And I don't know why. I haven't been watching anything, like, different than I normally do. I haven't been doing anything different. But I've had two different dreams now that have been, like, movie-level crazy. And I, like, remember each so vividly that it was, like, I literally watched a movie. Like, I still remember it now. Because normally I'll have, like, a really cool dream and I'll remember it for, like, an hour after I'm awake.
Yeah.
And then I completely forget it. But I still remember vividly now. They've been about aliens invading Earth. As I'm, every time I'm at a mall when this happens. One was the mall in Aberdeen. That was the first one. And the second one was, like, I think a mall I've seen in a movie before or something.
Not even a place you've been to.
No. But the aliens, like, come down and they just, like, straight up have been killing everyone.
Oh, gosh.
And somehow, like, I've been there with my whole family. Like, you've been there. Uh-huh. Our whole family's there. Drew and some other people have been there. And the only way that, like, we have found to kill them is with holy water that apparently they sell at, like, you know the store, like, Attic Salt and those other, like, yeah, kind of, like, nerdy-ish, like, very strange? They sell a lot of weird.
A lot of niche.
Yeah. Niche they apparently, things. Like, that's where I've been going, stores like that, and buying holy water. And I guess there's Skorkuns that they're also selling in the mall somewhere. And so the only way we've been able to kill these aliens is by spraying them with holy water from squirt guns. And also there's been like this strange like giant Nerf gun type of thing, but it shoots like those giant like soft gator skin balls that you used to use in like gym class.
Yeah.
You shoot those out of a gun and you somehow there's also holy water on those that also it kills them. And I don't know why this is happening. And they've been, like, scary dreams.
Let's
like,
say, are you enjoying them? Or are it's they been, terrifying?
Like, very cinematic. Like you're sirens enjoying have been going off. Like, mm-hmm. We're about to die. It's very strange. I don't know. But I've had two now. And at this point, I could write a whole movie off of this. And I think it'd be a good movie, too. Because it's very, like... It totally could happen, but yeah. Also, like, it couldn't. It's just, I don't know. But it's not, like, scary enough that I wake up from a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
It's just, like, I, like, am in my dream feeling the fear that there are aliens invading the planet and I have to kill them.
And you wake up like you had an action movie dream?
Yeah.
Like, you feel like you watched an action movie, so but weird. It was also your dream?
It's just, I don't know why that's happening. And I told Drew about it today, and I didn't even tell him about the whole thing because I thought he'd think I was crazy. So I was like, I know where I'm going to tell this story. But yeah, I think it's a combination of watching Nancy Drew with Mom,
mm-hmm.
but also like, I don't know where the aliens are coming from because that's not something.
In Nancy Drew?
No, that's just a lot of supernatural weird stuff that happens in that show.
Yeah.
But I think like the last season that we just watched, they had to like sound the alarms that, you know, they're town was going to be flooded or something like that, like they need to evacuate. So I think like that's making its way into my brain.
Maybe.
But anyway, I guess get holy stock up on holy water, you guys, just in case.
Those gator skin balls.
Yeah. It's so weird. And like the malls, like at first you're just like shopping in the mall and then like you're walking through the whole mall and then all of a sudden every single worker in the whole entire place is gone. And it's just, like, still full of people.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the dream I had last night, right before I woke up this morning, we, like, went into this store. And on the outside of the door, it said, like, World War III. Like, evacuation World War III on, like, the outside of the taped window. And the last part of my dream, we went into that store. And it was, like, halfway abandoned. Like, they had, like, an end, like, store closing sale.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, like, something in a picture frame that I liked, and I picked it up, and, like, in my dream, I was thinking I was gonna put it in my office. That was, like, the last part of that dream last night, this morning, whenever it was.
So that was a process. That was something that happened while you were actively fighting aliens.
Like, what? Priorities. I was like, I'm not gonna die. I'm gonna take this home to my office. Oh, so weird.
My exciting things are the water heater's been out for the last few days. So yesterday I boiled a pot of water and I poured it into a bucket and then I added some cold water to that to make warm water and then that is how I bathed.
Why don't you just come here and shower?
Because then I'm wet and outside and it's cold.
I guess.
I don't... It takes a very long time for my hair to dry. And then at work, we've been digging and we have a backhoe driver right now and he has a little poodle that he brings with him and the poodle rides in the front of his overalls. And today, we all went to Cracker Barrel together, and the dog obviously stayed in the car. The dog is not in his overalls at Cracker Barrel, but he asked for a doggy bag, and he just picked all the dog appropriate leftovers off of everyone else's
that
plate
is
and
so
made a little,
cute
thing to take home to so that the puppy can.
Yesterday, I saw this video on Instagram about this like someone's grandpa that orders extra chicken when he goes to restaurants so he can take it home for his cat. And
he was literally picking up that he got fried chicken, and he was taking the little bits that he had not eaten off to
That's
put
so
into his
cute.
Little dogs.
It's literally something I would do for Finley
so
and Opry.
Okay. Are we ready for a story time?
I think. I feel like I just told my story. Literally, I can't stop thinking about how weird they are. And then I'm like, is this going to happen? No. Well, at least I know how to kill them and I survive, apparently.
Confidently.
Yeah. So much so that I'm taking souvenirs home from the mall.
Go decorate.
I think you go first.
Okay. It doesn't matter.
I think.
There's no pattern on purpose.
I know.
So.
Go ahead.
Did you do a paranormal or a true crime?
Paranormal.
Great. Okay. So, I'm covering the Crossbell Ranch. My sources are OKQHA.org, which I think is like Oklahoma Quarter Horse Association or something like that. Backroadmysteries.com and Oklahoman.com.
You know, I know you're doing a true crime, but you said ranch, and I immediately thought this was about aliens. Because every time there's a ranch story, it's about aliens in, like, the paranormal world.
This is definitely true crime.
I was like, oh, aliens? Did I manifest this in my dreams?
So, Eugene Claremont, who goes by Gene, and especially in my story, he's going to go by Gene, because he also has a father who's Eugene Claremont. So, Eugene Claremont Mullendore III, so technically there's three of them, but we only talk about two. So, he's going to be Gene. He's born around 1938 to Eugene Claremont Mullendore Jr., and Kathleen, maiden name Boren Mullendore. So Kathleen was born in 1905 in Caney, Kansas. And after her birth, her parents traveled 45 miles to register Kathleen with the Osage Indian Agency, which is in, like, Osage County, Oklahoma. So they're just north of the Oklahoma border in Kansas. Anyway, so they went and registered with the agency, which made her eligible to get a 640-acre allotment of land within Osage County. And I don't know what this means, but she also was eligible for interest in mineral rights within the Osage Reservation in Oklahoma. So I don't know if that means she gets shares or if the mineral rights on those 64 acres she gets part of. I don't quite know how that works. Either way, her parents got her set up pretty decently for a rural Kansas child.
Kansas?
Yeah, she's from Kansas, just north of yes. Osage County, which is in Oklahoma. I believe she is of Osage descent, but I didn't actually look into that. I totally forgot.
Okay.
But as she's registered with the Osage, I'm thinking she has some Native ancestry. So, starting in 1926, after they got married, as in Kathleen and Eugene, that's what I'm going to call him, adult, the older Eugene is Eugene, the younger Eugene is Gene.
All right.
Anyway, so, starting in 1926, after they got married, they went to these 640 acres, and that became the, like, center for what they managed to grow into 130,000 acres worth of ranch by, you know, buying up the land around it, which is Crossbell Ranch. So they did real good for themselves. Mm-hmm. It was one of the largest cattle ranches in Oklahoma. Their operation focused primarily on breeding quarter horses for cattle management and Hereford cattle. I don't know the cow types. Anyway, so they bred quarter horses and this specific kind of beef cattle. And at one point, they managed to become, or maybe they still hold this record. Either way, they have been at some point in history, if not still, they were the largest cattle shippers on the Santa Fe Railroad. So they're shipping out a lot of beef. Mm-hmm. They also raised hogs to sell and also feed the family and the people who worked there, because like it's a massive operation. You have to have, like, you know, live-in cowboys.
Yeah.
To maintain all the cattle. They also kept goats to clear the land, a number of dairy cattle, which supplied the ranch with milk and butter. They kept sheep for the purpose of harvesting their wool to make things like blankets. They produced wheat, corn, apples, pecans, and potatoes for, I understood, to be their own consumption, as well as baled a sizable amount of the hay they would need to stay their cattle for the winters. And they used mules to pull their wagons, because this is still early enough that that's common.
Yeah.
So overall, Kathleen and Eugene seem to be very business savvy, practical, and resourceful. You know, going they're from 640. They're great at running their farm. Like this is a multi-million dollar.
Yeah.
Farm that they have. Enterprise. Ranch that they have. Yeah. They're doing good. So they're apparently known for their Mullendore mules. They were known as some of the best mules in the country. At one point, they sent up 600 head to Kansas City to be sold to the government to use during what I think is World War II. They just said the war.
It's one that is not written about in the history books, and you will only learn here on this podcast.
The war. For 600 Mullendore mules.
Was it a war only with animals?
I don't know.
The donkeys were kicking all the coyotes in the head. That's what the war was.
But, like, they get married in 1926, so it can't be World War I, which would make more sense. It has to be World War II, but I didn't know they used a lot of mules in World War II.
Sadie, we're uncovering the government secrets.
The Great Mule War.
Just me saying that we're going to get flagged by the FBI or something.
So Eugene oversaw the ranch, so I assume that means the, like, animals and plants. Well,
the
donkeys
oversaw
and
the boar.
Mules.
Mules.
And then Kathleen oversaw the main house, the cookhouse, which I assume fed all of the staff and possibly them as well. And she kept the books.
She's a smart lady
that she is a trained pilot.
Oh.
Who would fly over the ranch when animals would go missing and radio into Eugene so they could find them.
Why is she so cool?
And then she'd also...
I want to be her when I grow up.
She'd also fly to town to buy things they couldn't produce for themselves, you know, grocery-wise, as well as, like, you know, car parts and farm equipment.
Yeah.
And, like, rather than driving into town, she would just fly into town.
You know, if you got it, fly it. That's what I always... That's my motto.
You know. You're right.
All so, the aircraft vehicles that I own.
Eugene and Kathleen eventually built a school for their kids, Jean and Catsy. Catsy's the older sister of Jean. As well as any of the children of the staff and the cowboys that lived on site,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it wasn't just the two kids at the school. It was all of the other children as well, which is real nice of them.
Yeah.
So Gene's sister, Catsy, married John W. Mecom Jr., which people are going to be so angry that I don't know how to say his name because he's the owner. Like, he was the owner of the Saints, like the football team.
I couldn't even tell you what state that's in, so be mad at me for that. What is it? The Saints?
Saints, yeah. New Orleans Saints. Their symbol is the Fleur-de-Lis.
Definitely. Nope.
Anyway.
I know that team. And now that you say it, I literally picture their logo. Right now, I guess I'm brain dead thinking about aliens. So that's not coming into my mind.
So, yeah. So, Catsy married the man who owned slash owns, I assume he's dead by now. owned the Saints, and she also had a pet buffalo at one point named Geronimo, which she broke to ride. So she seems to have
family.
An equal amount of spunk to her mother.
They're living my dreams.
So Jean was married to Linda Vance, and together they had 4 children.
Vance Refrigeration.
That's what I kept thinking of.
I really just butchered that so bad, but everybody gets it. Everybody gets it.
So in 1960, management of the ranch transferred to Jean due to his father's failing eyesight. And he was set to inherit the ranch anyway.
Yeah.
Which... Whatever else I've written there is something I've already said.
Let me straighten my legs.
I'm gonna get a drink then during this grand pause.
I don't know if that's any better, but my knees are really hurting. I'm so old.
Can't sit cross-legged?
Oh, okay. Well, I sat cross-legged most of the day at work.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay. Ready?
Yep.
So, between 1960, when Jean takes over, and 1970, he managed to accrue a massive debt of $12 million.
He's ruined everything.
He's ruined everything. He's 100% ruined everything. What the heck? He apparently liked to live a very extravagant lifestyle.
Okay, well then steal your sister's money. Which is, or something.
It's crazy that he's living beyond his means when they were genuinely rich.
When they were already doing that?
Yeah, like his mom
owned a plane?
And flies to get their groceries. But at the same time, they also make their own butter, so...
You know, you save where you can. And it's you spend true. Where you it's can. It's true.
Anyway, so his wife, I assume during this 10 years of great debt, eventually moves away to Tulsa with the kids to Jean, doing whatever Jean's doing, and starts to prepare to divorce him.
You go, girl.
Which is fair.
I would, too.
So now we get to why this is true crime. Because unfortunately...
Him squandering all the money.
It's not that.
Surprisingly.
So, on the night of September 26th, 1970, Jean was found dead in the den of his home on the ranch.
Dun, dun, dun.
Where he'd been beaten and shot between the eyes.
Oh.
His bodyguard, Damon Chubb
Anderson. He's a bodyguard and he lives on a farm?
Why do you say farm that way? You know, maybe one of those cowboys was going to come and get him. Who knows?
It's one
anyway.
Of the war mules.
Those war mules. Vendetta.
So, genetically modified war mules. You're not safe.
So his bodyguard, Damon Chubb Anderson, was found shot in the shoulder. Anderson claimed that he had been upstairs drawing a bath when he heard a shot and rushed downstairs.
As all bodyguards do.
I never said it was for Jean or for himself.
Probably. You know, I'm picturing it's just for himself. He's giant buff guy. Just up there getting his bubble bath ready.
Anyway, so he rushes downstairs where he saw Jean, I wrote clumped. I definitely meant slumped on the couch. So, I shouldn't laugh right here. This is where he sees Jean.
I was going to say, I guess this is a dead body.
Slumped on the couch and bleeding.
Okay.
Okay. So as Anderson approaches the body, he is shot in the shoulder by 2 fleeing men. And the investigation is carried out, and I assume this was tribal police, because, like, all of Osage County is the Osage Reservation, mm-hmm. but no sources ever say it's tribal police, but they also definitely never say it's the FBI, which would be the other option. Like, yeah. It has to be tribal police or the FBI on a reservation, from what I understand. The investigation was botched.
What year was this?
1970.
As most were back then.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, this is not abnormal for the time, in the slightest. So, the scene was disturbed before any physical evidence was gathered. The body was removed and embalmed before an autopsy was performed.
No. That's not how you do it.
So, other than that, though, they did do, like, an extensive and thorough investigation. But they had no leads, and no one was ever charged. So, there are a number of theories about both motive and who was the murderer. Most theories have something to do with Jean's debt, which is obvious. Mm-hmm. That would be, in my opinion, the biggest motivator. So anyway, there's speculation that it was the mafia, and that the mafia had been owed a significant portion of this debt.
That's
and
what
so
I immediately offed thought him. For some reason.
You always think the mafia, Audrey.
I do.
There's also something to consider that there was a $15 million life insurance policy on his life.
Who was collecting?
His wife was the beneficiary. And after a lawsuit, and I don't know what the lawsuit is for because I don't know how life insurance money works, she eventually was awarded $8 million of the $15.
Wow.
I have no clue where the other went or if anybody ever got it. I think it just might mean, well, because his death was suspicious and we can't prove it wasn't you, you don't get all of it.
Yeah.
That's why I assume there had to be a lawsuit, but nothing told me that. And the final, like, main theory is that Anderson was involved.
The bodyguard.
So 40 years after the murder, apparently, and this is all
speculation.
No. This is all from this PI, Gary Glanz, who apparently worked on the original case. This PI is the one who is the one telling the story. We never hear from Anderson himself because he dies a year after he tells Glanz this story. So Anderson said that he was the one who, in fact, killed Jean during a particularly violent fight. And I don't know if that means he beat him to death on accident or if guns came out. Like, I don't know, based on the story he's telling, if it is he accidentally killed him in a brawl or if he pulled out a gun and shot him between the eyes. Either way, it's said that the fight started after Anderson delivered Jean divorce papers. Like, he was the go-between for, what is it, Linda?
I don't remember.
Vance is her last name. That's all I remember.
Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. Why can't I say refrigeration?
It's a complex
that
word.
That is sad.
So anyway, to go along with this story, Anderson said that, again, this is all from Glanz again. Anderson never says this to anybody other than Glanz, apparently. Who does that? It sounds like I'm saying glands, like a glandular issue, but it's Glanz, G-L-A-N-Z. So Anderson's apparently said that he got help from a ranch hand, Lonnie Joe Brown, who was also his brother-in-law, to stage the murder after he accidentally or purposefully killed Jean to make it look like intruders did it, which included Brown shooting Anderson in the arm.
Okay.
But as Anderson only ever may or may not have confessed to this PI, that he is not... There's absolutely no proof other than this confession that was to a secondary person.
Yeah.
That he did it, so it's still considered an unsolved case.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, a man died, but what makes me even sadder is everything, like, that's gone now because of what he did with his parents', like, hard work.
Yeah.
So after Jean's death, his father, who was suffering from... numerous diabetic complications. You know, like, I think he'd even lost a leg.
I was going to say, he probably lost limbs.
If not, at least toes, if not limbs. He had to take over the ranch again.
Oh.
In 1972, the ranch filed for bankruptcy to pay off Jean's debt. And they refinanced. This included a $5 million insurance policy that paid off some of it. And they had to sell a lot of livestock and property. It was one of the largest modern land auctions.
Oh, that's so sad.
That's how much land they had to sell off to
cover
Jean's
debt. Daughter should have helped. She's richer than can be.
She goes and takes over.
Oh, okay.
We'll get there. I don't know what... Maybe her husband didn't share money. Maybe I didn't look into her marriage with her husband. Who knows? I don't know. Anyway, so... Eugene ran the ranch until his death in 1972, after which Kathleen took over until her death in 1998. In Kathleen's later years, Catsy, the daughter slash sister, moved back to help with the ranch, and then she took over after Kathleen died, and then she ran it until 2017. I do not know where it stands now. I don't know how big it is now. I don't know who's running it now. I don't know. Maybe it all got sold off. Anyway.
Well, it started out so great.
I was so frustrated with Gene that I didn't call the story after him. I called it after the ranch. And really, the only reason I told you this story is because Kathleen is so cool.
I know.
And the parents were so ingenious so to get cool. They did such a good job. And for all I know, maybe they did some really sketchy things to do that well. But, like, all of the different things they were doing to maintain their space when they were so isolated makes me hope that they were just hard workers.
That was a good story.
Thanks.
All right. Now it's my turn. As Opry settles. Lay down. Lay down, sissy. She's so tired. Look at her.
Well, now I get told a ghost story.
Okay. So my story is about the Overholzer Mansion. I think I said that right.
Overholzer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm gonna move again.
You know, I'm sitting on my ankle weird. Hold on.
Okay. My story is about the Overholzer Mansion, and I got my information from overholzermansion.org, Wikipedia, and oklahoman.com. So the history. In 1889, Anna Ione Murphy, 18, married Henry Overholzer, 43, who had wealth in several states, and they arrived in Oklahoma after the land run and constructed major buildings in the town. Oklahoma City is the town,
I was going to say which town.
I know, I just realized I didn't put that in there. In 1890, the Overholzers had a son, Henry Samuel, but he only lived until about 6 months old.
Oh, no.
And when Henry Overholzer purchased three lots in the newly developed Classen's Highland Park addition in 1902, many people questioned why he and his wife Anna would build a house so far out in the country. Which I think it was only like a mile from...
It's so far.
Or like a mile or two from town.
Maybe it's when cities are all the rage.
I don't know.
Why would you be a plebeian and live on the land when you can live in town?
Yeah, I don't know.
Where everybody poops in the street.
It's so sanitary. But in 1903, the mansion was constructed by Henry, who was known as the father of Oklahoma City. The Overholzer Mansion is considered the first mansion to be built in Oklahoma City. The Queen Anne and Chateauesque architectural styles of the house were regarded as out of style and took into stark contrast to the Mission, Craftsman, and Prairie styles of architecture that had began to become prominent in the area at the time.
What year was this?
1903.
Oh yeah, they're late. That's real late for those.
When Henry and Anna opened the door of their home to guests, I cannot talk this episode.
It's okay.
When Henry and Anna opened the doors of their home to guests, their choice of style was not questioned. The following appeared in the February 28th, 1904 issue of the Daily Oklahoman, shortly after an opening event. The house is a sermon on beauty. It is uplifting and ennobling.
What?
Ennobling is literally what it said. And I literally had to, like, read it three times to make sure I wasn't saying it wrong. But this is what it said in the article I was reading.
How do you spell that?
Ennobling.
E-N-N?
O-B-ling.
Ennobling?
Ennobling.
Is that how you're supposed to say it?
I don't know. That's how I want to say it. So, it is it is uplifting and ennobling as works of art are ever. The taste with which it has been decorated and is being furnished is flawless and shows a praiseworthy mastery of the subject. And the whole Overholzer house is an incomparable example of the possibilities.
I think it's definitely supposed to be beautiful home
building.
Ennobling.
Ennobling is what I'm calling it. The house is...
What?
Help!
Oh, 11,700.
That's what I was going to say. The house is 11,700 square feet and cost $38,000 to build. There is also a carriage house on the grounds, which is about 4,000 square feet. The home remained a center of social life for decades, hosting weddings, dinners, and literary events. It was also the place of birth of their only daughter, Henry Ione, in 1905. I could not stop giggling. I could not stop giggling when I read that. And at first I thought it was a typo, and then I kept reading, and later on in the article they kept mentioning her, and I was like...
They call her Henry Ione, or just Ione, or just Henry?
I don't know. I have no clue.
Call her Henny Penny.
It just cracks me up for some reason. You couldn't do Henrietta or something?
We really didn't like Henrietta. Maybe they knew a Henrietta they really didn't like.
You know, maybe. I don't know. I just thought it was so sad. It cracked me up. Throughout this time, the home remained in the hands... Wait, throughout what time? Oh, just all the time from 1905 when she's born, I guess. Throughout this time, the home remained in the hands of the Overholser family. Henry had a stroke in 1911 and never fully recovered, and he ended up passing away in 1915. So his widow Anna continued to live in the house until her death in 1940, when the house was passed to Henry Ione and her husband, David J. Perry. And then the Perrys ended up having no children, and when Henry Ione died in 1959, David J. Perry was left as the sole heir of the mansion. With the historic value of the Overholser mansion in mind, Perry sought to see it preserved as a living tribute to the 89ers, which was the group of people who arrived during the year following the Oklahoma land run.
That makes sense.
On June 22nd, 1970, the Overholser mansion was officially listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and less than 2 years later, on April 14th, 1972, David J. Perry achieved his goal of preserving the mansion by selling the house, including all of its contents, to the Oklahoma Historical Society. At the ceremonial deed signing, Perry said it was Mrs. Overholser's wish that it go to the city or state, and she would be very pleased. And today, the mansion is owned by the Oklahoma Historical Society, where they still do tours and everything, and I believe they do ghosty tours as well. On to the hauntings. The hauntings were longer than I thought they would be. Some claim the ghost of Anna Ione Overholser, once the queen of Oklahoma City Society, still glides through the mansion. Many visitors have said they've seen a petite woman in a white gown with her hair up. And the ghost is easily identified by these people as Anna, from a picture of her in the mansion where she's wearing a pearl-decked lacy white gown with her dark hair piled gracefully around her face.
How nice.
Neighbors and passersby have seen curtains open and close in the third floor windows. I always think that's icky.
Yep.
U.S. Senator Mike Monroney?
Where? Sure, Monroney.
Mike Monroney and his wife, Mary Ellen. I always like Mary Ellen together. I don't know why. Stayed in the Overholser mansion in the 50s and 60s because they were friends with Henry Ione and her husband, David. I can't get over Henry Ione. One evening, Mrs. Monroney was coming down the stairs, and she saw a woman in white walking across from the front parlor to the music room. She also described the woman as Mrs. Overholser from the picture.
I like it when semi-credible people also see the ghost.
And actually tell people they saw it. Since the home is now open for tours and is a museum, they have motion detectors set up around, you know, inside the house. And they are often set off at night, sounding alarms, but no one has ever been found after these alarms have gone off. Spooky, spooky.
Crazy.
The current museum coordinator, Lisa Escalon, said that she and other staff members will hear their names being called throughout different rooms, which I hate.
I don't like
that ghosts can learn your name and then just scare you on purpose.
I don't like what that says about that whatever that entity is.
Yeah,
not a fan. Not a fan that it can learn.
It's spooky. Nancy Singletary worked at the Overholser Mansion from 2003 to 2006. One morning, she had arrived to work as a movie crew was setting up across the street, I'm assuming to film with the house as the background. She paused in the mansion's front yard to talk to a crew member, and she told him about the history of the house. And he asked, "Who's living in the house now? They're up on the third floor." Mm-hmm. And she said, "No one lives there now. It's a museum, and it's totally locked up until I unlock it." Nancy said his face turned white when she told him that no one was living there. And he said that he had seen the curtain move on the third floor and saw someone in the window behind it.
Ew.
Isn't that terrifying?
Well, and I like that it's not someone who's looking for a ghost. It's someone who thinks someone lives
just
in the
looking
main,
at like, a pretty, you know,
like,
house and wondering.
Who gets to live there now? Like, this yeah. house is so cool. Like, I'd like to know.
He's probably
like,
oh,
to go
like,
inside.
It's a museum. There's probably, you know, apartments on that third floor.
Yeah.
And now he's like, I cannot sleep tonight.
Oh, gosh.
And then over 30 years ago, Kathy Dixon was a curator for the museum, and she had helped move some of the Overholser's personal belongings from closets to make more room for new ductwork. And one night after a long day, she had an odd dream, and in this dream, she saw a young woman wearing a Victorian ball gown walking down a hall in the mansion.
Well, she
Speaking
was in holy
of
water.
Dreams, yeah. Holy water and
I think
gator skin.
Solve it.
Dodge
I think
balls.
Both of those things would solve this issue.
She had never seen, like, a picture of any of the previous owners, and she wasn't sure if it could be the, because she works here, so she knows,
yeah.
like, of them.
Yeah.
So she didn't know if it would be, like, the daughter or the mom, and she saw the same picture one day of Anna Overholser, where she was wearing the exact same dress that she had seen in her dream, that white pearl one that everybody sees her in.
Yeah, and that's the mother.
Yes. Henry's the daughter.
I know, but I was making sure it wasn't, like, some other woman that I was supposed to remember.
Then, about 15 years ago, Dixon said a visitor of... This was 15 years ago in an older article, so don't take these years for exacts. But she said that a visitor of the mansion said, quote, "Anna wants her Bible put back on the table." And there's no context behind who this is. Or where they got this information.
Somebody's passing comment as they're leaving the gift shop. Oh, by the way, Anna, she wants her Bible put back on the table. I don't know what you can do about that, or, like, you know, if you could help her with that, but she seems very
distraught. I'm assuming
distraught.
It's some kind of psychic person, or maybe, like,
I like
she
to think it's
showed
a random
herself
person.
To this guest and was like, "Hiya," and they're, like, talking, having a conversation. They're like, "Yeah, I'm Anna," blah, blah. And she was like, "Yeah, I'd really like if they'd put my Bible back." And this person's just like, "I'll tell them. I will let them know, and I will get out of here as fast as I can."
I mean, maybe they didn't know it was a ghost.
Yeah, I don't know. But they give no context behind that. So
we can
Dixon's
speculate as much as we want.
Confused. She's confused as well by this mm-hmm. comment. And says that she didn't know anything about a Bible belonging mm-hmm. to Anna. So she asked around, and she found someone who knew the house better. And they told her that Anna's Bible was being stored in a closet. But this article said nothing about them putting it back on the table.
I like to think it's still not on the table.
Anna will not rest until her Bible is out on the table.
Maybe that's the goal.
Maybe that's why everybody keeps seeing her. And only one person has been able to hear her so far. Another time, while alone in the mansion, one early Tuesday afternoon, Dixon said she kept hearing muffled voices in animated conversations between the music room and the library. She couldn't find an explanation after searching all over the home and said to an empty house, "Anna, I guess your friends came to visit. Have fun." So, either later that day or, like, later that week, she said that she had asked someone who knew the Overholser's habits and learned that the first Tuesday of every month was Anna's regular monthly bridge party. Cards were dealt promptly at 2 p.m., and she and her friends gathered to play in two spots, the music room and the library.
That's funny.
And that's the end of my story.
That's a fun story.
I know, I found it, and I was like, this one seems kind of fun, just by, the background history.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay. And then I kept going, and I was like, this is actually pretty good.
Yeah, no, I think this looking for shorter stories to help with your school thing is...
It gives, like, better value almost to the paranormals.
Where it's, like, it's not that I've been looking for long stories, but also, like, I needed them to be a certain length.
A lot of the ones that I find have, like, long histories, too. Mm-hmm. But that's the end of our episode.
I liked them.
All right. If you like this, go and leave a review. Follow us on Instagram.
I even want to say like and subscribe, but like we, don't have, subscribe we don't have
to YouTube. Our YouTube channel that I will probably never make because I editing videos is something I have no clue how to do. The last time I edited a video was probably like 8th grade.
Yeah,
No, it was my sophomore or junior year of high school, and I had to edit one just of pictures, basically, for a college thing for an English class.
Weird.
Yep. That's the last time, and I don't remember anything. All right, well, try not to kill anyone and don't mess with Ouija boards.
Bye.
Don't forget your holy water.